I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Today's episode of The Unmistakable Creative is brought to you by our friends at Advisor. If you haven't given the app a try and you're looking for more practical how-to advice, like finding more clients, coming up with a tagline for your brand, or building a more loyal community, be sure to download the app. And if you download the app and tweet or Instagram a picture of it with the hashtag unmistakable, we'll send you a free 9 environments assessment from former podcast guest Jim Bunch. Again, that's Advisor. It's available for both the Android and the iPhone, and it's completely free. Now, let's get into today's episode. In this episode of the podcast, Itay Talgham shares his leadership lessons from the vantage point of an orchestra conductor's podium.
Itay, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. So I came across you by way of my literary agent, who we both happen to have in common, Lisa Demona. And I remember when I saw your book on her shelf, I said, you know, I really would love to have him on the show because we've never had a symphony conductor on the show. So on that note, can you tell us a bit about your story, your journey, your background, and how that has brought you up to everything that you're up to in the world today?
Yes. Well, professionally, I was trained as a orchestral conductor. That's what I studied after completing my army service. I was 22. I was 4 years away from making any kind of music. I did do some training in the leadership, being an officer in a combat unit. And that somehow combined very well with my ambition to conduct orchestras. I realized that it was something conductors had in common with other leaders. So I studied in Jerusalem and then also in Italy and France and in the United States. And I had immense luck to be a student of some of the greatest conductors of the generation. Leonard Bernstein, I think, would be the greatest, along with Claudio Abbado and some other wonderful conductors. And for about 15 or 18 years, I was practicing mainly conducting, teaching conducting in music academies, but also being a music director of several orchestras, and mostly in Israel, the Tel Aviv Symphony Orchestra, the National Opera Orchestra, etc. But also elsewhere, I had a position with a National Orchestra of Romania, and I conducted as a guest with some of the world's best ensembles, like the St. Petersburg or the Leningrad Symphony, as it's called again, in Russia, and the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra, and some other great ensembles. Along with a feeling of discomfort with my role as conductor and the way the classical music industry was making me, along with my collaborators, produce products I was not really very happy with, because of the condition dictated by the conditions dictated by the industry. You know, the lack of money, the great expenses, and the need to produce products. I had a growing satisfaction from a parallel line of work which I developed, which actually started completely by chance. Somebody asked me to give a lecture to a group of senior managers of a certain bank, but made clear that those managers were not really into classical music, so I better come up with a different angle. And of course, I didn't have to invent the metaphor of conductor as leader. As I pointed out, I was aware of it for a long time. I thought that I could try something new in actually the way I could use this metaphor to actually help those people in business and later in many other walks of life to actually observe themselves through the distant mirror of orchestral conducting.
So let me ask you this. Let's start at the very beginning of this. In fact, I want to go even further back than, you know, studying music. I'm really interested in sort of the formative experiences of your early childhood and the people who shaped and influenced you that would lead you to go down such a path and choose such a career.
Interesting. One such great influence, well, there's nothing surprising about that, is my parents. My parents are very Israeli. I grew up in Tel Aviv, very Israeli kind of mixed couple, where my mother's family fled Warsaw in 39 after the Nazi invasion and miraculously make it to Palestine, while my father's family was had its origins in Syria, in Aleppo. For five or seven generations, they were already living in the old city of Jerusalem, speaking Arabic, that was their native tongue, and a little bit of Ladino because they were Sephardi. And of course, this Ashkenazi part from Warsaw and the Sephardic part, they fell in love while studying law. They were both lawyers and then both judges. And both families didn't find it very easy to accept the new cultural diversity they had to take into their family. But finally, all was well. And I'm actually, along with my older brother and younger sister, and you know, kind of a mixture of quite eclectic, different cultures. I could see it not directly influencing my choices, but maybe a very basic thing about my my way of looking at the world. I see a great potential in diversity, in differences, in gaps. That's the expression I chose to use in the book. As I said, rather than seeing myself as representing something in a kind of unified and strong way, I find my strength coming from really being made up in a way that's actually holding together my father's Arabic, my mother's Polish, their love for what they did in the law, and also their art collection and the music they love. Very diverse worlds coming together. That I think is the most single important influence I could point to.
So let me ask you this: how does somebody who is the son of two lawyers and judges end up in a highly creative career that is almost the polar opposite? In terms of one path, which is safe, secure, and guaranteed, or so we used to think, and one that pretty much is not. I only know this because I actually got into the USC School of Music when I was in high school, and my dad talked me out of going. And that's very much a cultural thing. So I'm really interested in sort of how that plays out in the Israeli culture and how you deal with that dynamic of choosing to go down a creative path when you have parents who haven't.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, you know, my parents were lawyers, but they had—I don't think they had one friend from the business or from profession. All their friends were artists, bohemians. That's how, you know, they started creating their. They have one of the finest art collections of Israeli art out of, you know, just being friends and being interested in the lives and works of their friends. And it's again, I think they also loved the what they did professionally, but you know, they also faced all kinds of, I would say, dissonance in the profession. I mean, as judges, they were definitely different than others, and some of their verdicts were heavily criticized by the Supreme Court because they took a different approach than for example, my father, very early in his career as a judge, declared that he did not believe in severe punishment. People that you punish and send to jail for many years are just becoming more and more professional in their, you know, criminal whatever they do, and he thought better send them back to society and try to, you know, make them into citizens again rather than criminals. Just to give you an example. And many other revolutionary verdicts and judgments that he passed, and so this did also my mother in many, many different ways. Really was advocating the idea of making people reach agreements by themselves without the court having to actually pass a sentence, and it was again criticized because she was sometimes she had to push quite you know, aggressively for that, but her efforts led to some kind of mechanism that now works very well alongside the formal process in courts. So what I'm trying to say is, it doesn't matter what you do. You can, as you hinted to, you can be a conservative. You can just say, okay, this is the way. This is the way to become a musician. That's what you have to do, and keep on the good tradition. And you can be a kind of a rebel or an innovator. And I think even before this idea of disrupting even came into the world, they were already this kind of innovators. And I think I took that from them. They didn't mind at all that I did something completely different. And I think they were very, very happy with my also change of career, because after all, you know, I studied to be a conductor. I was quite successful as a conductor, and yet I chose to be a conductor of people in business and you know, and in education and in management, rather than a conductor on the stage. They were happy with it.
Well, we'll get into all of that. I'm still really interested in digging into sort of the earlier part of the journey. Do you think that you showed sort of an early inkling or an early signs or indications that perhaps you were destined to go into music? And the reason this is fresh on my mind is because I've been reading a book by Jeff Colvin called Talent is Overrated, where he looks at people from all walks of life who are peak performers. And it's just a really kind of interesting look at whether or not we are destined to become something or we actually can become great in a particular field. So I'm really interested if there were early indications of the fact that you might end up going down this path.
Well, it's not something I really thought about in great depth, but I think there was a sign again of creativeness, of, you know, not doing exactly what, you know, I would buy those plastic models of tanks and airplanes, but then I would assemble them completely differently into new kinds of imaginary vehicles or aircraft and all that. So I think if you look at a kid that plays like that rather than, you know, follow the instructions and get a true to life model, you say, okay, well, either he's, you know, he lacks the skill or he's actually inclined to think differently out of the box. So I think I was in a way doing things like that. I think I was also very quick. I mean, in terms of you know, school and all that, I didn't really take very seriously. I didn't have any books or notebooks or anything. I just remembered everything and it was easy to pass the tests and all that. I don't think I made the you know, I could gain much more if I really studied seriously, but I didn't. And therefore I had a lot of time to do other things, which I did. I was very much into film and philosophy, which I ended up studying at the university later, and music, of course. As a teenager, was studying a little bit of conducting, composition, etc., which was not part of the curriculum of my school. It was just, and it was all my idea. My parents were never involved in any of those decisions.
So let me ask you this. How, as adults, do we start to uncover those kinds of things in our lives if we are wanting to make changes in terms of the direction that we're going?
Well, if I go back to the my very authentic feelings, which I the ones that I reported early on in our conversation, you know, I think it's always, you know, the two things working together. You feel that something is not right, and you feel that there should be something which is better for you. You know, any great change, if you know, one has to unfortunately get divorced or something like that, it's probably those two things together. If you don't believe there's something better that could make you and possibly your ex-partner happier, maybe you don't want to go through this hell. But if you know there's something better, and if you know there's something wrong, deeply wrong, then there's a very, very good chance that you will actually change something. Of course, I do recommend, if I can, or wish everybody to have more of this positive motivation rather than just a feeling that it cannot go on this way, something is wrong. But usually the both will be there, and then you have to really look into what is it that causes you to makes you suffer, and what is it, you know, in different things that you do in life that really make you happy. In my own change of career, I had to agree to myself that although I love music deeply, it is not the fact that I raise my hand and put it down and 100 you know, different instruments played together the first note of Mahler symphony or something, which makes me happy, but to look at the people play and to see their faces and to see how much we're all together and going in the flow, that was my main satisfaction. So of course you cannot do it without being, you know, also a good musician. I'm not saying that it's enough to, you know, to try to be nice with everybody and feel good. Of course not. But the real achievement was for me always a human. The coming together and the harmonization of human beings rather than sounds.
So here's a question that I've asked in some form or another. You know, I think it's interesting you brought up the idea of divorce or some sort of terrible catastrophe, and then you mentioned that, you know, ideally it's, you know, you do this in a positive way. I seem to be consistently finding that crisis becomes the point of change for so many people in their lives. And I am wondering if that is a necessity or a rite of passage to transform into who we are ultimately destined to become.
Crisis is a very dramatic situation, and a very, very dramatic word, of course. But some sort of feeling of things are not as they should be. this deep discomfort when one actually discovers a gap. I go back to this word, you know, you think that you ought to be feeling this and that, and you find yourself feeling the other way. You think that if you put enough effort, people will smile around you, and you put the effort and they are angry. You know, things like that. It doesn't have to be a suicidal, God forbid, situation, but you can definitely see some kind of dissonance, a deep dissonance, and the problem, I think, is in most situations, maybe not when you're actually forced to do it because there's no other way, but you know, in most organizational situations, people will, you know, cover up the differences. The it doesn't work, okay, it doesn't matter, as long as we make enough money, it's okay, we'll give some bonuses, people will be happy and go home, and you know, in 2 years I'll move on to another job and somebody else might take care of this dissonance. People don't want to be associated with problems or with problematic situations. And even if they would agree with you and with me that this crisis or just situation of discomfort is the key to a new and successful thing, then I think most people will try to look the other side and avoid it. And this is what I preach against in my book.
Today we have three sponsors for the show. You heard me mention Oddvisor at the beginning of the episode and on multiple previous episodes. Just imagine having a world-class set of mentors and advisors right there in your pocket. It's available on both the Android and the iPhone, and it's completely free. So tweet or download the app with the hashtag unmistakable, and we'll send you a free 9 environments assessment from former podcast guest Jim Bunch. The folks at Marketing Profs have put together a marketing writing bootcamp. They know that if you're a marketer, and even if you're not, your job likely involves writing. The course will cover all aspects of writing and is taught by some of the best and brightest minds. The classes are available online and on demand, so just like the podcast, you can learn from your computer, your tablet, or your smartphone. And as a special offer to our listeners, they're giving a $200 discount. So visit mprofs.com/unmistakable and use the promo code unmistakable. You'll also get $1,000 worth of seminars, video tutorials, and classes for free just for registering. And finally, QuickBooks. If you work for yourself, you can save up to 50% on an entire year of QuickBooks Self-Employed. It helps you separate your business and personal expenses, takes the guesswork out of your estimated quarterly and yearly tax payments, and helps you maximize your deductions. And believe me, when you do this, it gives you a very realistic picture of how your business is performing, so you can make any necessary adjustments to ensure that you have an amazing year financially. So visit tryselfemployed.com/creative. Again, that's tryselfemployed.com/creative. Now, let's get back to the show.
Okay, so before we get in the book, I want to ask you one last question about these sort of early formative years, and it's about the Israeli army. You know, most of us, I think, are only exposed to what the Israeli army is through movies, through television, through media, and because I have you here, I'm really interested in how that time serving in the Israeli military has shaped your perspectives on life, leadership, and everything else, and how it's impacted everything that you've done with your career going forward.
Well, I have to say, I think things, of course, things change all the time. I think we're talking about, what was it, between 1976 and 1980. So it's a long time ago. And things were different. The general feeling about, you know, how necessary it is and how detached from the arguments of politics, internal politics, the army was. That was a better time, and it was in between wars, which was a great luck. I didn't have to actually. Although later there was this awful 1982, the first Lebanon war, and I was there as a reserve officer. And that wasn't a great idea, a great positive experience, of course. But go back to your question. It was a wonderful lab to learn about yourself and about others, because one thing the Israeli army didn't have then at all, and that was formal discipline. You know, I was a lieutenant. I had colonels, the head of the regiment or whatever. They would issue a command, and then I would between me and myself try to assess whether it was right or wrong, and I could go back to them and say, what is this? This is nonsense. And not only I could do that to my commanding officers, my soldiers. If I issued a command or something and it was unnecessary or illogical, they would come to me. They would never dream of doing something that was against what they believe was. I had to convince them. You might think that it has nothing to do with what you know about army discipline, but I agree. But this is how it was. And if we happen to have once in a while an officer that thought that only because he had the higher rank he could tell you what to do, those people would learn very fast that in combat units people simply wouldn't take it. And the one thing you cannot do in a combat unit is just to make it. I have to tell you, our Bible, so to speak, was Catch 22. You know this very well, and this is the book about all the absurdities of army life. And we were happy to quote from it to whoever needed to learn something. I learned a lot about what it is to be a real leader rather than just a commanding officer.
Hmm. Okay, so I think this makes a perfect setup to sort of shift gears and to start to talk about how you brought those lessons from leadership to the podium, and then what are those and how they translated into the corporate world and the business world.
Okay, how should we start?
Well, I guess really where I want to start is, the lessons in leadership that came from your time as a symphony conductor first. Like, what kinds of things have you brought from that into the work that you're doing today? And then we'll talk about how we can apply it on our own lives and how it's applied in organizations.
I have to say, when you do something, when I was practicing conducting on a daily basis and having to, conduct a rehearsal in the morning and then a concert at night and then in between study the scores for the next program, I didn't have really time to think about what I was doing. And I was just going through the routine and coming to the new orchestra and assuming that everybody knew the routine and everybody knew that we had very little time to prepare, et cetera, et cetera. And this is exactly the source of my discomfort, because I couldn't think. I was too much inside the thing, and there was no moment when I actually said, look, now I know things that I should share with the world. This came much later. In fact, I think that the best conducting lessons I got were when I was observing conductors with people that are not musicians. Already, in this kind of talks or workshops or seminars or whatever that I do now with people, and we observe together conductors and we speak about them. And of course, if I speak to doctors, they speak in their own language. If I speak to entrepreneurs, high-tech people, they bring another language. And I think from all that, I learned so much more. And then I used what I could gather and collect from all those people, I think tens of thousands that I met, to actually look back on my own career. And therefore I could really understand now for the first time things I couldn't. And you could say, maybe it's not, it doesn't testify to great powers of observation on my behalf. True, but maybe it's a good lesson, because it really tells me something about the ability to learn something through looking at another discipline with other people through dialogue. Again, the things that I do now.
Okay, so we're going to get into that. I want to ask you one specific question about this. You know, you looked at things that had nothing to do with your own career, and then you went back and looked at your own career, and you connected the dots between the two things to come up with, you know, what it is that you do now. What I'm actually interested in is how we might apply that process in our own lives, like the process of observation, connecting dots by looking back at our own lives and our own careers.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes a lot of sense. I think, again, I think people really have to take the time, first of all. Somebody has to say, okay, take the 2 days, go to a retreat and think about things, or you have to do it yourself, which is very, very difficult. And again, as you said, mostly people will do it in states of discomfort or great hope for something new that suddenly is on the horizon. So take the time and then find that distant mirror, because if you're looking at yourself in the same mirror you shave every morning in front of, you will see the same thing. Now you don't have to go necessarily to an amusement park and have all those weird mirrors that gives you funny shapes, but there are all kinds of things that can serve as mirrors. But this is actually the role of a teacher. In Judaism, there's this famous saying of you should find yourself a friend and a rabbi. In Christianity or Buddhism, you will find the same. So a friend, we can think together why a friend, but a rabbi, of course. I think it helps a lot to find somebody, not that they'll tell you what to do or what is the right thing for you. No, that's not a good rabbi for me. A rabbi is somebody who can help you do your own observation without imposing his or her knowledge. And it's very important to be able to get some help in order to be able to look outside of yourself and again get a new perspective to look at your own life.
Hmm. Okay. That's probably one of the most thought-provoking parts of the conversation. And it's interesting because, as I'm listening to that, I like it because it makes you think. It doesn't give you a roadmap for how to do it.
No.
I don't believe there is one. I think it's a very introspective process, and I think that whole process is one of discovery.
I think that's the only way to discover something, not to be told, because if you're told something, and even if you believe it with all your heart, you're just putting aside the real need, which is to look into your own, gaps and discomfort and et cetera, et cetera. You should really help, be helped, but again, not by anybody's prescription, but only by the ability to hold your hand and help you to overcome what it is that holds you from really observing your own stuff.
Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit and let's start talking about how you translated this all into the business world and, what it means for people who are listening, how we can apply this to our lives. What are the lessons that you have basically gathered that have become sort of the message of this book?
The first is maybe something which we already mentioned, which is the way to go forward, which is actually to open yourself to observation. Now, what should you observe and how? There are three main elements that I somehow put together. And I'm sure that they're not, everything, and maybe not even the best way to refer to what one needs to do. But at least they are, an honest attempt. And I'll tell you what those three elements are. The first is ignorance. And I call the book the Ignorant Maestro. I really think that if you want to discover something new, even concerning yourself, and you do it based on your knowledge of yourself, then the conclusions are already in set, embedded in the knowledge. Nothing new will come out of it. Now, of course, you cannot make yourself ignorant as to yourself. You cannot forget everything. But if you find a way to disassociate your knowledge from your exploration, that might give you a chance to learn something about yourself. It's not easy to do. In a little while, maybe we'll speak a little bit about what can be a good way to try and do that. But speaking about leadership, that is not only looking into yourself, but actually looking around you. There are other people, there's an organization. It is also very, very tempting to say, well, I'm leading you, therefore I have to know better than you, otherwise there's no meaning of me leading you, right? I have to know better, and therefore you have to follow me. If you act out of this belief, then it means that really nothing new can come, not only from you, but also from the other people. They'll, at the best, they'll just try to say things that you're going to like. They're going to try to guess your mind and give you the answers you want to hear. So, first of all, ignorance. Second of all is, what are we exploring? And we already touched upon that. I think we're exploring mainly gaps, things that don't really work. And not work does not mean that they are failures or that you have to be ashamed of doing something wrong or not at all. It could come from simply that belief that, well, there should be joy in the room when people are working together, and there isn't. Results are good, we're making profit, etc., etc., but something is missing. And now, why is this missing? How can, this is a gap. This is something that shouldn't be there, or should be different, and that's what we would like to explore. And quickly, the third element is, what is the tool with which one can become, by choice, ignorant and look into gaps? I call that keynote listening, as opposed, of course, to keynote speaking, which all leaders are supposed to know how to do. You have to have your leadership message and you have to tell people what to do. I say, what if you could actually set the agenda by listening, by creating a culture of listening, in which new things can really come to life, and this is the main working tool that I recommend to everyone who wants to explore gaps and is willing to choose ignorance.
Okay, so a couple of questions about this. One is about this idea of disassociating knowledge from your exploration. And it's funny because my first thought was, you could do drugs, you could get drunk. Those would disassociate your knowledge from your exploration, but probably not the most appropriate ways to do it. I'm interested in how one could go about doing this.
Think about a teacher. You know, in the old way of teaching, the teacher has always superior knowledge to that of the student, right? And what the teacher does is to pour, so to speak, his knowledge from his superior position into the head of the student, and therefore the student knows more and more and more, and he almost can reach the level of the professor. But then they tell him, of course, this was only the first part of the course. Now you have to go to the second part, which what I'm trying to say is, in the old kind of teaching, the student is always inferior to the teacher. That means that the student is never emancipated, always depends on somebody from the outside. In the new kind of teaching, first of all, the teacher and the students are supposed to have equal intelligences. Even though somebody knows more or less about a certain thing, doesn't mean that he's more or less intelligent. We know that very well, right? And so, starting from this point, the idea is that the teacher now, even though he knows something, really does not use his knowledge to tell the student where he has to go in his exploration. Rather, he is there to make sure that the student doesn't give up. So it's more validating the process of asking questions and advancing in one's exploration rather than validating the outcome or the result of the process. In the old teaching, you had to validate the result. I teach you A, therefore you know A. In the new teaching, I help you in your quest regarding A or B or C, and you may get to new knowledge that I, as a teacher, never dreamt about, never knew. And that would make me a good teacher. That means that as a teacher, I managed to disassociate myself from my knowledge. I didn't impose my knowledge on you, and therefore I opened the way for you to discover something new. This is what I mean by disassociating one's knowledge. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, no, that makes all the sense in the world. That was profound.
Now, I have to say, this profound thinking is not my thinking. it's very important to say that even the name of my book is an homage to a French philosopher. His name is Rancière. Contemporary of ours, teaches in Paris, and Rancière wrote an essay called a book, actually, The Ignorant Schoolmaster, in which he actually speaks about the work of another French intellectual, Jacotot, in the 19th century, and that Jacotot actually invented, if you want, these ideas. He came up with this remarkable and revolutionary and wonderful claim. He said, an ignorant can teach another ignorant what he himself, the teacher, does not know. And now you have it as a summary of everything I said before. And I feel very good being based on Rancière, which is also based on Jacotot, because these are great ideas that go through the centuries in philosophy. But the wonderful thing would be, of course, to take these ideas and translate them into education. And then what I do or try to do is take those ideas and translate them to leadership. That is, much like the ignorant schoolmaster, the ignorant leader does not really tell everybody where to go, but rather helps them in their quest to find the next valuable, meaningful goal for themselves. And that is quite revolutionary as applied, I think, to leadership.
Wow. Okay, so one last question before we start wrapping things up. You know, one of the things that you talked about is this idea of dissonance and bridging and this gap between, where we are and where we want to be. I'm interested in hearing about bridging that gap.
Well, that's, if I may say, a wonderful question because, let's say that, let's take a gap which is not that intimidating. Well, again, let me get back to the moment where I, for the first time, put in video in front of my quite unsuspecting businessman that I gathered for a session, a piece of orchestral concert, and somebody stands there and conducts. And I asked them just to say what they see. Now, they say something again in their own language. And of course, there's a gap between their language and the language of music. Now, I could do one of two things. If I was a teacher of the old kind, I would say, hey, guys, what you say is very nice, but actually in music, we call that a downbeat. And what you've seen now is a process of crescendo leading to a rubato where the stretto, and all that. And I would be teaching them. Of course, it has no relevance, no importance to their lives. That's no good. Now, if I didn't refer to what they said at all, that was not no good either. So what I have to do now, coming back to your question, is to try to bridge that gap in a kind of a temporary structure that will give them enough sense of what's happening in a musical way, but will give them, even more importantly, a sense that what they say in their own language about it is just as valid. And instead of just saying, oh, let me learn something new or learn about music, no. Stick to what you think. And now let's see how one language can shed light on the other language. So it's a very, very, very sensitive play where actually the leader, this was not a very difficult process, but in a process where you find that you have different stakeholders holding different interpretations or different opinions, and you don't say, okay, I'll tell you how it's going to be, and that ends there the whole thing, but you try to keep all the voices alive, try to put forward some kind of platform to hold all those voices and allow for a dialogue between them, and even allow the dialogue itself to change the platform. So if you thought that the main metaphor for your organization was family, and you let people somehow use this platform of our familial relations, but at the end you find out that they see it differently. They want to see, they want to see a combat unit rather than a family. And you have to be, again, open enough to help them discuss something which is rather distant than your initial intent was. So actually finding the bridging, the platform which bridges the gap and helps the discussion, and which may even transform itself within the discussion to something completely different, that's the main leadership challenge. It's something so complicated that I don't think I actually had something conclusive to say about it. Definitely not conclusive. But I hope it gives you a something to think about.
Hmm. Wow. Well, Itai, this has been really, really insightful and thought provoking. So I have one final question for you, which is how we close all our interviews here at Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Is there such a thing, unmistakable? I think it's the authenticity of being willing to put yourself, you know, in an open way, in an honest way, to the examination of others. So many leaders that I know, conductors, you know, conductors that look around them and all they see is the instruments. Instead of saying, Mr. Bloom, can't you play this a bit louder? They say, first oboe, play it louder. They only see instruments. There are others who see professionals, who consider the master oboist and connect through a professional perspective. And then there are others like my great teacher, Bernstein, who can combine not only those perspectives, narrow in a way, but really have a whole person, you know, dialogue where you speak with people about the meaning of music and you mean, you know, speak to me from your own life experience, everything you know about suffering and about joy and about this and that, and your overplaying and what you know about Mahler and all of that. Now, I think if somebody comes with the whole spectrum of the human being and puts himself or herself, you know, quite openly in front of you, that's quite unmistakable.
Well, Itai, I have to say this has been thought-provoking and insightful, as I expect it would be. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your journey and your insights with our listeners here at The Unmistakable Creative.
Well, thank you. It was a sheer pleasure. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
If you like what you heard, the greatest compliment you could give us is to share the show with a friend and let people know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening to The Unmistakable Creative.